response.
Is your business struggling to be seen, not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, line starts here.
Welcome to Sunday Take. It's July 12th, 2026. I'm your host, Blois Olson. We are exactly 1 month, or as of Tuesday, 4 weeks away from the August primary. And the primary has, as we've talked about, many facets this year, from both statewide competitive races on the Republican ticket, one major well-funded statewide race on the Democratic ticket, a congressional primary in CD2. We have a few legislative primaries, and then we have some nonpartisan primaries. So we're going to begin to shift to Sunday Take debate mode starting next week. Next week, we will have a debate, a primary debate, between the three candidates in Congressional District 2 running to replace Angie Craig. The Republican nominee is Eric Pratt. He's a state senator. And we'll have a CD2 debate during the general election. But next week, we'll have a CD2 DFL debate between Matt Klein, Caleb Berg, and Matt Little. That'll be live at 9 o'clock here on News Talk 830 WCCO or on your Odyssey app. But we will definitely be previewing it in the newsletter this week and so forth. Second, Fluence Advisory, the consulting side of my shop, just on Friday came out with our Fluence memo on what to expect in the next legislature. This is the first of two memos about looking ahead. Of course, there are elections that still have to happen, but the next legislature is going to probably have some fiscal challenges, tighten the belt. Obviously, we're going to have a new governor no matter what. 85% of the legislature has only served under Governor Walz, who is seen as pretty deferential to legislators, while most governors are much more kind of bullish on what they want and usually get about 80% of what they want. So you can download that memo if you go to fluence-advisory.com, click on the insights tab. It's about 6 or 7 pages. We list who's retiring, we list who could be leaders, and some of the things that'll be on the table in the next session. This past week, it started to set up as two issues that have been volatile for a couple years and one for the last year. They are immigration and elections and election administration. On immigration, Operation Metro Surge, the impacts of it, the feelings about it, energized Democrats, which we've talked about a lot. They've also kind of polarized much of the Republicans on key points as well. You know, why didn't the governor cooperate more? Why did protesters protest so hard, etc.? That's not the way I think this will play out in the election. I think it certainly will play out in the election. I think it will be part of the ongoing discussions in the election. But I think there's a split screen after the last week. And that split screen is what happened in January and February, and then what Democrats did that may have been a little bit of an overreach. It's been in the headlines for over a week, and the hardening of this immigrant of Hmong Laotian descent was significant. Tu Vang was then deported this week by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. This was after he was pardoned by Minnesota officials. I want to be clear, Tu Vang had, you know, been pardoned because the victim wrote a letter of support for him being pardoned. But even in that case, it's such an extreme step in many people's minds that the backlash has been significant. Amy Klobuchar has said that she usually wasn't in favor of pardons, and then this week said she would not have voted for a pardon in this case. And that brings us to the split screen that Democrats, especially in legislative races, are going to attack Republicans who didn't vote to ban federal agents from schools, etc. And Republicans are going to attack Democrats and link them to this pardon, especially in the attorney general's race, since Keith Ellison is part of that pardon board. This has the opportunity to become one of the things that Democrats can't get off their shoe, the gum that can't get off their shoe, and could create a narrative that really, with public safety being a top five issue in Minnesota, really kind of twist some of the major trends that we were seeing and close the gap there. There's still a major energy gap. Democrats have more energy than Republicans. Trump is unpopular, but the split screen on immigration is going to be a factor, especially in a couple of key races. And then finally, the topic of this week's show is, I'd say, the shuffling of the deck when it comes to the federal role in administrating our elections. Let's be clear, states administer elections, but they do it with federal support. Since 2016, when it was clear that the Russians were trying to interfere with cybersecurity and other means, we saw that and people really stepped up their election integrity efforts on both sides of the aisle. And the federal government began to brief all secretaries of state on security and potential hacks. Now, this week, we've had election advisory council members fired by the president, one resign. And this is the organization that helps support states in administering elections, making sure that everybody's up to par in their technology and in their practices. And then finally, it was flagged that, like before, that the Justice Department will have some civil rights monitors in Minnesota for the August primary. I thought it was a good time to catch up on how this all works. I think confidence in Minnesota elections remains high. I think it's important that we have a transparent process and we talk about it. And so with that, when we come back, a conversation with Secretary of State Steve Simon. He has to work with local units of government to administer these elections. Let's be clear, votes are counted at the local level and reported to the state. So this really is a grassroots process, a bottom-up process of how elections happen in Minnesota. What does the federal changes mean for Secretary Simon and our local government officials? And what is he doing to fill the gaps that usually would be held by the federal government? I'm Blaise Olson. You're listening to Sunday Take on News Talk 830 WCCO. Joining me on Sunday Take, as I mentioned in the open, is Secretary of State Steve Simon. There's just a lot of moving pieces in our election this year. And it's not about the politics, although maybe it is. It's about the administration of how people vote. Secretary Simon, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You had talked earlier this week just about security briefings, cyber attack preparations, all of the things that have traditionally been done in partnership with the federal government weren't being done. Without obviously revealing too much, what are the things that you've been burdened with state resources to do as we get ready for an August 11th primary and a November general election?
Well, just to zoom out, and you alluded to it. We have, for the past decade or so, relied on the federal government in partnership to help us administer elections from a security standpoint. And I got to give credit where it's due. I'm talking about the first Trump administration. They were great partners, really reliable, and the tail end of the Obama administration and the Biden administration. And for whatever reason, in the second Trump administration, they have really walked away from this mission, not just as to Minnesota, but as to all 50 states. So you alluded to a couple examples. We used to be able to rely on them for some intense and expensive cybersecurity help, basically white hat hacking, where you invite them in, they come in and they physically and otherwise try to hack your system. They do everything they can to infiltrate and penetrate. They look and find the weak spots or the soft spots. Then they write a big report. They sit down with you and they tell you how to patch things up and make things better. That's something they're not doing. Another example is intelligence briefings. You know, all the secretaries of state in America get a secret level security clearance, and we get to designate 2, 3, 4 staff members to get the same if they pass the security clearance. And by now we would have had at least a couple, maybe more, of these secret intelligence briefings in a SCIF, in a closed area, where we get some of these threat assessments. We have had zero, and it seems to me at this point we're likely to get zero between now and election day. So to your point about state resources, the rough number we've been using is about $250,000, up to that amount, I would say. We don't know exactly what the final tab is going to be, but I just want voters to know we are backfilling. We are filling that void and filling that gap. About the only thing we can't fill is the intelligence briefings, right? You can't buy that off the shelf. You can't go find a consultant to give you the national security briefings, but the cyber stuff, the physical security, the planning with our partners in Minnesota, the tabletop exercises, and the security planning, that we are partnering with others so that nobody feels any difference. We're just doing it on our own dime.
Going back to 2016, obviously much of the coverage is about misinformation from foreign entities that it filled the media, fake websites, fake news sites. Some of them, you know, I found on my own. They were fed to me in algorithms. What other kinds of threats are there that require a security briefing from the federal government?
Well, one obvious one is cybersecurity. And remember, 2016 was the watershed year. That changed everything. That's the year when we now know the Russian government actively attempted to penetrate state election systems. I'm talking about in a physical sort of cyber way to breach security walls and get in. Now, in the case of Minnesota and most states, the defenses held. They didn't get in despite their best efforts, but it was a wake-up call. Yeah. And so it really started with all of that. The ability or the intent of some foreign actor, either a government or a non-government actor, to get into our stuff, to get into the databases, to get into sensitive information, to attempt in some way to hijack the administration of elections. Again, all the defenses have held, and we've relied on really good security cooperation until now with the federal government. But that's the kind of thing that we would get, broadly speaking, in these security briefings. So, for example, without giving away too much, they might say in one of these briefings something like, look, nation state X has been up to a bunch of mischief on the cybersecurity front over in this area over here. If it travels to you in the elections area, here's how you'll know, and here's what you can do about it. I'm painting in broad brushstrokes, but that's the kind of thing they would tell us in these briefings.
All right, now we have news that there's monitors coming for the primary election from the federal government. Have we had that before? How do they engage? What does it mean? And why Minnesota, or are other states having monitors as well?
Yeah. First, let me say, I totally understand why anyone in Minnesota would view this Justice Department with skepticism when they say they're doing something like this. After all, on a number of levels, they haven't been straightforward. They haven't been honest. I don't think they've often acted in good faith, and that's unfortunate. That said, they have, under previous administrations, including the Biden administration, sent monitors to Minnesota and other states, and it has to do with the provision of the Voting Rights Act, having to do with non-native English speakers. They're doing that again, so that part isn't new, that Minnesota is one of a handful or a couple of handfuls of states. What is new is the nature of this particular Justice Department. So what we've said is, look, you or anyone else in Minnesota, when you're doing this observation, you got to follow our laws. And our laws are really strict about what they can do in the polling places. They can't disrupt. They can't get in the face of or even speak to any voter. And those laws will be enforced. But as long as they're abiding by the laws, this is something that they've done before. But I don't blame people for being very skeptical and, viewing them with some suspicion.
How would you enforce those laws in Minnesota?
Well, this is part of the training that election judges receive at the county level. They are trained for exactly this. And it doesn't matter whether it's a DOJ observer or someone off the street. We have very clear and very precise rules in Minnesota, not only about who's allowed to be in the polling place, but what they're allowed to do once they get there. And they are instructed to call in law enforcement. I'm talking about police, sheriffs, and otherwise, for people who do not follow those laws. And that applies to everyone, whether it's from Washington, D.C., or anywhere in Minnesota.
When those monitors have been called to Minnesota before, how many have there been? Are there certain parts of the state they've been in? And do you know anything about the plan this year on how many monitors there'd be and what parts of the state they would be in?
Far as we can tell, it's the same number and largely the same. It's one place where they have frequently sent monitors in the past is Ramsey County, and that has to do with the language issue, particularly with Southeastern, those from Southeast Asia, and making sure that they're enforcing parts of the Voting Rights Act. Again, that's in the past. We'll see if they abide by the rules and do the same thing this time. But in the past, if that's what you're asking me, it's that kind of thing. So I'm not yet seeing anything that is departing from the patterns in either the number or where they tend to them. We'll learn more in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure.
And traditionally, would they work with you on that, or do they just do their own work and kind of report to you? Is there a partnership? Because obviously we know that in other ways, the federal government just hasn't partnered with sharing information with the state the last, 7 or 8 months for sure.
I think I wouldn't go so far as to call it a partnership, but I'd say in the past, regardless of administration, they have, as they did this time, let us know about it in advance. So it's not just a surprise. They do need under the law to work with and have a partnership with whatever local jurisdiction is running the polling place. That is required. And as far as we can see, that is happening at this point, which is good. They've got to do that. You can't just show up on election day and say, surprise, we're here from the Justice Department. And they haven't. So we're going to be watching. Everyone's going to be watching to make sure they follow our laws and rules, just like anyone off the street. As long as they do that, we'll be good.
When you talk to other secretaries of state, Democrat, Republican, how other states administer their elections, just to remind our listeners that it is states and local governments that administer elections, not the federal government. What's the sense? What's the quiet part that maybe we don't hear out loud from Republican secretaries of state? And they have to worry about cyber attacks as well, don't they?
Yes, they do. I don't want to speak for anyone, but I can tell you my general, the vibe that I get is people are concerned and frustrated by this retreat by the federal government. And it's not just about the money. We're trying to find the money. We are finding the money. We're backfilling. It's about this retreat, this rupture, really, in a partnership that, I'll say it again, existed even in the first Trump administration. I give them a lot of credit. I did then, and I will now. They were really good partners, and as was the Biden administration after that. And there is some frustration about this abandonment of this partnership we've had on cybersecurity, on national security, on physical security when it comes to elections. And so there definitely is a frustration there. But my other sense is that states are doing what we're doing in Minnesota. They are backfilling, they are gap filling, they are finding ways to get those services elsewhere. And I have to say, I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to be good. You never know. You always hope for the best, plan for the worst, of course, and we're doing that. But generally speaking, I think we should be in good shape on the cybersecurity front. We feel good about who we're working with and the record so far.
We're going to take a quick break, but we're talking to Secretary of State Steve Simon. We're talking about kind of some shifts and changes related to the federal government's involvement and oversight and security briefings, as well as I want to get to the idea of what's changed with the way in which the federal government personnel. We had a couple resignations and a couple removals this week. When we come back on Sunday Take on News.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies Rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Stockade 830, WCCO. We are back on Sunday Take. My guest this week is Secretary of State Steve Simon. We're talking about some of the kind of, I'll call them logistical issues with the federal government. Secretary Simon, earlier this week, there was some folks removed from a board. A Republican resigned from the same board. Can you explain what that board was, what its role is in elections across the country?
Yeah, so this is a group that most people have never heard of. It's called the Election Assistance Commission, EAC. It started in 2002, and it exists to help states troubleshoot certain issues when it comes to elections administration, whether that's voter registration, whether that's just providing more people more avenues to know what the rules are in their particular state. So they go around the country and they help with things like social media and communications, and they're really involved in helping to certify the elections equipment to make sure that we have a standardized system of knowing that the equipment is sound and secure. And there are four commissioners, two of each party, Senate confirmed at the U.S. Senate, that were fired this last week. I mean, one had already resigned a little earlier. One resigned just under the wire here, and the two Democrats were fired. Now, the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision just a couple of weeks ago does entitle the president to do that. But I think this is a bad look and a bad move so soon before an election. It basically means that this organization will not have any leadership between now and the November election. Seems hard to imagine that they could get three people, which is what you need for a quorum, to get Senate confirmation between now and 100 plus days in the election. So it's unfortunate. Some of the work is still going to go on, no doubt. It's not like the whole agency is set packing, but they can't make certain major decisions because they don't have people at the very top. I don't know why someone would do this. This is not a D versus R thing. It's not a blue versus red thing. This is just about getting good information out there. But it looks to me like part of a pattern of disengagement or worse. I mean, whether it's Homeland Security doing what we talked about earlier, whether it's this back of the hand to the EAC, whether it's the FBI raiding the Fulton County, Georgia elections office, whether it's these data grabs from the Department of Justice, which has us in litigation right now, it's a pretty unmistakable pattern of the administration trying to put its stamp on elections and grab power for the federal government or disable current partnerships that are helping states. And it's unfortunate. I'm a glass half full guy, though. I think we've got good laws, good rules, good partnerships, definitely the resolve in Minnesota. We're going to have a good, clean election no matter what. We just don't like having to do this despite the federal government's involvement. We'd rather have them as a partner, as we have in the past.
This is a midterm, and so we're used to Minnesota having good elections. We're used to trusting elections in Minnesota, no matter what party you're with. Are there states that this could impact more, and what are those states going to do, or what are the concerns about other states that maybe don't have as solid of election administration as Minnesota?
Yeah, without naming particular states, I would say, yes, it could have an impact on states that don't have the traditions or the rules or the culture around voting that we do. The other thing I'd point out is, like in any election, you're going to have truly deeply purple states where at the margins, things like this could get really political really fast, right? Not that Minnesota isn't competitive, but there are states that are truly like 50-50 down the middle. Some of the presidential swing states where I would imagine this is just going to get, like I said, really unnecessarily political. And so, look, all of us want the same thing. We want elections that are fair, accurate, honest, and secure. That's what we want. We welcome the partnerships when we have them. But when they just dissolve with little explanation, and when our own federal government seems to be putting unnecessary obstacles in our path, that's not helpful. That said, again, I'm optimistic. I think we're going to get to a good place in terms of a clean and honest election in Minnesota. But It didn't have to be as hard as they're making.
Well, as we wrap up here and talk about these things about election administration, we have an August 11th primary. How are we doing at the local level on election judges? How are we doing on the way county election officials feel? And what, contingencies are there, or what will we learn maybe from the August 11th primary that maybe, informs November and any curveballs that are thrown at the state?
Boyce, you put your finger on it. The August primary is always a really good dress rehearsal for the November election. Not that it's not important in its own right, but it's a good way to work out the kinks and the bumps and do things better 12 weeks later. So I feel really good about where we are on election judges. It takes 30,000 election judges every election in Minnesota. That's a small army. I always ask that question of our partners in the local government. They're the ones who recruit and train and pay them. And they're telling me they feel good about that. I think morale is pretty high. Our folks are doing house calls all over the state. I was just with a bunch of county people from all over Minnesota on Friday at a conference that we stood up for that purpose. So I think people are feeling good. And we've got a lot of real veteran professionals in the counties and in cities across Minnesota who are doing a great job under a lot of pressure. But this is a good dress rehearsal opportunity. See how things shake out. And though you didn't ask this, I'll tell you, in terms of turnout, given some of the hot contests on the ballot, we could do pretty well for a primary. Anytime you get over 20%, that's considered really, really good. The last time we did that was 2018, because there was a lot of action on the ballot on both sides, and we could get there again, given some of the contests out there.
Well, it's interesting you say that because, we're doing some modeling at Fluence on turnout, as we do every year. So, thanks for that little tip on, my wag on where I'm gonna focus turnout. Let's just foreshadow some scenarios. We've seen in many cases where states' attorney generals have stepped in when the federal government has done something. They've teamed together. Is there any preemptive work you anticipate attorneys generals will try to do before the election, or will they just be prepared if they need to work together to bring part of the election or the administration to court if the federal government oversteps?
Well, I can't obviously speak for attorneys general, but I can tell you what I know about what's going on the ground, which is there is a lot of planning going on, particularly jointly with attorneys general and secretaries of state, for exactly this, gaming out various scenarios and how we would respond. So to answer your question, it's mostly about responding to stuff. It's tough sometime to go to court before the thing happens because the court will say the thing hasn't happened yet, right? But particularly in the responsive lane, a lot of thought is going into what the scenarios could be. And just for your listeners, this is a normal thing to do in an election. We have to plan for all the worst stuff, even if it might never happen. So every election, we have to plan with our partners for things like a blizzard or a bomb threat or a gas leak or whatever. Not because we're predicting that thing will happen, but because it's the responsible thing to do, even if it's a low probability. And this time, added to that list of hazards is the possibility that our own federal government will do something directly or even indirectly to interfere with people's freedom to vote. Again, not a prediction, but just as we plan for the bomb threat and we're not predicting that will happen because we're planning for it, this is the same. It's in that category. And I can tell you that secretaries of state and attorneys general jointly are actively gaming out various scenarios and what the response would be.
Secretary of State Simon, thanks for joining us on Sunday Take. I know we'll talk down the line, and you can look for your debate invitation soon.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. I'm Blaise Olson. This is Sunday Take. When we come back, this week's take. Welcome back to Sunday Take. If you are wanting to follow the election more, go to fluenceelectiontracker.com. You can find it at our website, The Daily Agenda, if you can't remember that. But we're tracking all the races, and fundraising numbers will come out this week in the federal races. It'll give us an idea on the Senate races, where candidates are, especially in that CD2 race. The other race to watch is Congressional District 1 and fundraising numbers there. Jake Johnson, the DFL challenger to Brad Finstead, put up some impressive numbers. He's making some noise. It ironically reminds me of a race about 30 years ago where there was a lot of media attention, but in the end, Republicans pulled out that race. And for those of you who know, I was then on the campaign side for the Democratic challenger to Gil Gutnick 30 years ago. But this race has got some of the similar tones to it. This week's take is just straight up a call for sensibility when it comes to administering our elections. I have witnessed the misinformation. I have seen some AI stuff. I've even fallen for some of it. I use some AI content. Like the graphic for the debate next week was created in ChatGPT. It's effective, it's efficient. But the misinformation on social channels about Minnesota in particular spreads around the country. When I travel, people will say things. One example recently was that there was a large statue of George Floyd erected in Minneapolis. And I just said, there's not a statue of George Floyd, there's a memorial. No, I've seen a statue. And I said, I live there. And I don't think that's right. And it took that for this person to learn what was real versus what they saw online. Of course, we had a week of memes about a charter school. I urge you to read Evan Ramstead's column about our education system self-segregating through public charter schools. And how Republicans don't love public schools as much as they want choice, and the choice is charter schools. And yet this charter school was attacked by President Trump. I also want to call out that Governor Walz hasn't made a media appearance since that pardon that we talked about in the open was issued and called out, because he's going to have to answer some tough questions. But back to the election and misinformation. Look, I urge you to be vigilant in the information you consume and the information that you hear spouted back out. Minnesota has a trusted election system. It is run by 30,000 volunteers. Anyone can be an election judge. And I urge you to volunteer, to step up if your local community needs election judges. It's a day off, you make a little money, but it's a front row seat to democracy. And furthermore, you can't question the process if you are part of the process, because you see how it works. Scrub your algorithms. Be vigilant with your family. You can argue, Paul.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Politics all day long. We can argue about red versus blue. We can argue about these various things. But I must say, we have to keep our information clean. The news, the information, the content has to be clean. If it's not, it erodes the trust in the system, as we saw in 2020. Never proven, plenty of questions, but an erosion in trust in our fundamental infrastructure that runs our democracy. That's this week's take. I'll be with Vanita this week at 6:20. You can always look at all of our content at thedailyagenda.com. Next week, the CD2 DFL debate, Kayla Berg versus Matt Klein versus Matt Little, live at 9 a.m. Tune in, tell your friends, and until then, that's the take.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.